This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
It is an absolute disastrous mess. Never seen anything like this in my life.
That's the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter, describing the scene at that Amtrak rail disaster in the Port Richmond area. At least six are dead, scores are injured after Amtrak train 188 derailed while going around a curve. The why of this accident is being pieced together by many agencies, including Amtrak itself.
A thorough investigation will take place from this incident, led by the NTSB, and Amtrak will do everything in its power to assist in that investigation and has brought every resource in the company's ability to support that effort.
That's Amtrak's board chairman, Anthony Coscia. The Northeast Regional, carrying 238 passengers, was traveling from Washington, D.C. to New York. It derailed on a particular curve just north of a residential sector of Philadelphia.
We're looking at the track, the train signals, the operation of the train, the mechanical condition of the train, human performance. We are setting up a multidisciplinary investigation to try and understand the factors that led to this accident.
That's Robert Sumwalt, a board member of the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, at a news conference earlier today. Joining me now with more is Tom McDonald, news reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom, what's the scene like?
Well, they still consider this a recovery and rescue mission. The problem with it is a lot of people scattered to the wind after this. Not everybody checked in. And as you know, if you've ever ridden the train, sometimes you miss your train. So they've got to track down every person that was on the passenger manifest and make sure they know where they are, what has happened to them, if they're in the hospital or worse.
We've been talking with Tom McDonald from WHYY in Philadelphia all of today since this accident and its aftermath has been unfolding. And Tom, you described earlier this curve and how particular it is that it suddenly moves eastbound if you're traveling north on the train. And it is a relatively unusual area in an industrial part of North Philly. What are they looking at in that particular area?
Well, they're looking at a number of different things. They want to see what happened as the train took the curb. This train has a front-facing video camera, and they have recovered the black box. So the black box is on its way or is at Amtrak headquarters, which is in Delaware, not too far from here. They are taking all the data off that, and NTSB officials say they hope to have a lot more information soon, maybe even today.
We're not engineers. Is it possible that the train could have been at full speed? Was it far enough from 30th Street Station in Philadelphia to have made it to even close to top speed?
I would say that's highly doubtful. I grew up in this area. The train has to go across several bridges before it takes this curve, one probably within two football fields of the curve. So I doubt it was at full speed when it went into that curve.
And this has been a disruption in the Northeast Corridor. This is a busy passenger rail and freight rail corridor. What do you think the outlook is for the next few days?
Don't expect this to be back online anytime soon. They had to cut the catenary wires. They're the wires that supply power to the trains. The NTSB is going to want to take a look at everything that went on. And even at that point, they're still going to have to repair the track and the overhead wires. I would say this is several days, probably not before Monday.
The slow recovery, slow rebuilding and clearing effort as the train site of the disaster for Amtrak train 188 unfolds there in North Philadelphia. Tom McDonald, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tom McDonald is a news reporter for WHYY at the scene of the accident in Philadelphia.
The takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
legend of Zero Dark Thirty, the raid of the century, Barack Obama's moment of triumph, the capture of Osama bin Laden.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda.
The raid, daring and successful on that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, we were led to believe, was carried out in secret without the knowledge of the Pakistanis, whose territory Navy SEALs penetrated to kill the al-Qaeda leader. He was identified by CIA sources, including a heroic vaccination doctor who tipped off the CIA and was arrested by Pakistan for treason. Here's CIA Director Leon Panetta worrying about that source on 60 Minutes back in 2012.
He was not in any way treasonous towards Pakistan. He was not in any way doing anything that would have undermined Pakistan. As a matter of fact, if Pakistan's, and I've always said this, Pakistan and the United States have a common cause here against terrorism.
But there's a new version of this story with much less heroics. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hirsch says he believes that Pakistan knew where bin Laden was all the time because of a senior Pakistani official who gave up bin Laden years ago for a U.S. $25 million reward, that bin Laden might, in fact, have been a Pakistani prisoner, and that the SEAL team raid was a way for the U.S. to do the work Pakistan was too politically skittish to do on its own. Hirsch's account promptly was denied by the White House, riddled with inaccuracies, insisted White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest. But Carlotta Gall, North Africa correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, says she believes that a main part of the Hirsch revision is true, according to her own source, which seems to be consistent with what Hirsch has been saying.
Now, I'd heard this already. Many of us had heard this story right from the beginning, in fact, when bin Laden was killed in 2011. But few of us could actually corroborate it, and it was always, you know, anonymous sources and difficult to be really sure. But I learnt it from a source that I do really value highly and who had already given me some very important information on the whole bin Laden episode of living in Pakistan. And so I had understood the same, that in fact it was a Pakistani official who tipped off the Americans to his whereabouts in this house under protective custody of the Pakistani intelligence service.
And Seymour Hirsch would seem to have corroborated that with the sources on both sides, Pakistan and the United States. At least that's according to his account, which has been published in London. On the question of whether he was being held under the protection of the ISI, the secret service of the Pakistani government, could one also say that maybe bin Laden was being held prisoner by the ISI?
Yes, and I wouldn't go as far as describing it as prisoner, because I think it's a type of custody which is constraining, but it's also with some consent, because it's also protective. And I've seen this and learnt about this over many years in Pakistan, that they often do this with people that the intelligence service wants to use and control. And they do it, I believe they're doing it with Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, right now today. Pakistan has long done this. They have safe houses where they either imprison people or they control them so they actually cannot leave and they have guards. But there are other safe houses where they have a sort of consent to living there and they're kind of watched and controlled, but also they're sort of like a guest. So I think bin Laden was more that sort of thing, because he didn't have armed guards on his house preventing him from leaving.
So Carlotta Gall, when CIA director Leon Panetta says that he's very worried about this vaccination doctor who was taken prisoner by the Pakistanis for being arrested for doing treasonous things, he gave up the bin Laden compound. Panetta knows, according to this reporting, that that in fact is wrong, that they knew where bin Laden was because of this high-level source in the ISI.
Yes. Now, there was a whole story, I think, of even when you get a walk-in source like that, you then want to double-check it, you want to verify the information. And so I don't really know what they were doing with that doctor, but it seems he was running a sort of a program to try and get eyes on the compound and see who was inside. So in that sense, I think the CIA was using him and does feel guilty and does feel worried for his safety. So that I don't think that this new revelation of the walk-in actually necessarily contradicts that they also had this working arrangement with the doctor.
So let's go to the heart of the matter. Then if the ISI knew where bin Laden was and was keeping him in some sort of protective custody, you say, possibly prisoner, as Seymour Hersh suggests, then the entire bin Laden raid, described as this heroic exercise of U.S. covert ops, was in fact greenlighted by the Pakistani government and, on some level, staged. Yes?
It's hard to say for sure, but it would seem if they had, you know, an agreement with the top Pakistani generals, it was far less risky than we thought. But I don't know if that is the case. I'm saying, you know, don't shoot it out of the water, because there's one detail that I know I also learned about, but I don't know if Kiani and Pasha were in on it or not. I think a much more plausible thing is that the America learns this, and this is, for me, the heart of the matter, is that this walk-in proved what many of us had suspected for years, that Pakistan was protecting bin Laden. Bin Laden was the main person that had created 9/11, who had to answer for one of the worst crimes on American territory, and they quite rightly could demand Pakistan to hand him over or help bring him to justice. And so I think then that's when Pakistan is put on the spot, they're found out, and they have to come forward with some help to resolve it. So I think at that moment, America had some real leverage over them to help and resolve this. And I think that's why I'm still open-minded about, did they work with Kiani and Pasha on this raid, or did they do it because they didn't trust them without telling them? But the crux of the matter is it proved that Pakistan was protecting him. And that made, I think, America fully entitled to say, the game is up, you know, we've got to end this situation. I don't know how they decided on the raid, or if they told them or not, but I think that was the moment when it was all over for the Pakistanis hiding him all this time.
Carlotta Gall, North Africa correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Thanks so much, Carlotta.
Thanks a lot.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
You could feel the sting in the president's words sent out in an email after a defeat in the U.S. Senate for the Pacific Trade Bill. Quote, "We can't go back, and we can't leave it to nations like China to write the rules for the global economy. This is personal for me," Obama says in the email. "I understand the skepticism about this or any trade deal. I've met folks across the country who still feel burned by agreements of the past. Those are the people I came to Washington to fight for." But it was Senate Democrats who blocked the president's measure to begin debate on whether to grant the president fast-track authority on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. What now, Todd?
Hi, John. Well, what now is that bill hangs in limbo, blocked on the Senate floor by those very Democrats that you mentioned. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, can bring it up at any time. He might bring it back up at any time, but that doesn't depend on him. That depends on Democrats getting past their sharp agreements among themselves and with their own president. Here's what's been going on. John, there is no trust left among liberals for any free trade deals. A lot of them have never liked them. Many of them say that they were suckered into voting for NAFTA back in the late 80s and 90s because it's shipped U.S. jobs overseas and gutted environmental and workplace protections. So they don't want to vote for this trade deal. But if some of them, maybe a dozen Democrats who are pro-trade, are going to vote for a deal like this, they say they want additional workplace protections. They want new training for American workers who lose their jobs because of the deal, like if the jobs go to Asia. And they want a bunch of other provisions too, some of them having to do with currency manipulation, cracking down on China, and things like that. Well, John, all of those things got supported in the Finance Committee, and it looked like there was a big bipartisan deal to pass the bill with all of these protections, get enough Democratic votes, and give the president the big, giant notch in his trade bill that he wants for his agenda. Mitch McConnell wants it too. It all fell apart because when it reached the floor, Mitch McConnell said, we can do some of the worker protections, but we're not going to do these additional protections, closing loopholes, for instance, on child labor, currency manipulation, workplace standards. That stuff is not going to be part of this package. And when that happened, all of the Democrats, even the ones who were for giving President Obama his big trade deal, they all balked and they blocked it. And that's where we are now.
So it's a bit of unchallenged mythology about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Is it true what you said, that it gutted environmental regulations and worker protections and shipped jobs overseas? Or is that just what the Democrats believe is a campaign issue?
The latter is definitely true, that American jobs in many manufacturing sectors have been exported to Mexico. I think all of the data shows that. A lot more of it, like you're suggesting, John, might be subjective and might be liberal politicians responding to frustrated voters who are finding it harder to get jobs. But in this current environment, it's not really about those progressives anymore. It's about a lot of the moderates, or at least the pro-trade Democrats, who said they were ready to vote for this. Listen to Chuck Schumer. He's one of those Democrats. He's a leader. He's the next Democratic leader. He wants this bill to pass, but he wants to crack down on China too. Listen.
Regardless of where we stand on trade, we support the essential enforcement provisions that are the glue that holds these agreements together. Without them, American workers are left twisting in the wind.
Twisting in the wind. Is that offer in the wind for the president if he makes those agreements that it'll pass?
The next couple of days are about Democrats getting this in order. There is talk that they may drop the currency manipulation provisions. If that happens, you might have a deal that the president can still get his win, but we don't know yet.
Thank you so much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. In the beleaguered world of publishing right now, there is a central question. It's always been there, but technology is making it more pointed and painful. Do consumers choose to find their news and go to the places they trust, or do news sources chase consumers by going where they actually are? The New York Times is answering that question with a resounding both. Starting today, the New York Times will partner with Facebook to publish directly onto the social media platform, pushing content to Facebook users without having to go to the Times site, avoiding their website advertising and getting a speed advantage in loading the Times content. Joining me now is Gabriel Sherman, National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine. Gabe, is there a way to quantify the specific advantages for using Facebook?
Well, what's clear to me covering this story is that the biggest winner, the clearest advantage, is to Facebook. This entire program is designed to keep readers and Facebook audience within the walled garden of Facebook. And so I think the big battle now is going to be, what are publishers getting out of this arrangement? Yes, they're going to get some money, but are they going to retain that crucial relationship with the readers and bring them back either to the pages of their magazines and newspapers or to their own websites?
Is the content contributors, I mean, are they contributors to Facebook and treated that way? And so Facebook would have some sort of editorial control, placement, that sort of thing?
Well, that is one of the biggest unknowns of this deal. And,
right.
And the information coming out, it has not been clear. Facebook controls the algorithm by which users see headlines in their news feeds. And they are not, from my understanding, turning that over to publishers. And so publishers are basically saying to Facebook, we are going to trust you to not suppress our content. And the clearest example I can think of is if the New York Times commissions a major investigation into Facebook's privacy practices, would Facebook put that onto their news feed on it, you know, for their readers? And that's a big unknown.
Does the Times determine what content goes to Facebook? Can they choose which articles go and don't? Or is it up to Facebook to take whatever comes through the Times website and put that on?
No, so the New York Times is choosing which articles to share on Facebook. And right now they're starting with a very limited number. They're kind of branding this as an experiment. But it's not illogical to think that as this future develops and more readers just basically hang out and spend their time, all of their time surfing on Facebook, that the Times would essentially have to chase those readers and start turning over more and more of their articles onto the Facebook platform.
And the Facebook platform becomes more like a Google homepage. I mean, that's just an old sort of outmoded nomenclature, homepage. But basically, people are on the internet exclusively within the borders of Facebook increasingly, and that's really the advantage here.
You know, that's basically what you've distilled is the essence of what is happening to the internet. Facebook wants to control the mobile internet, and there's a sort of a future that Facebook envisions, which is that when you go think of the internet on your mobile phone, you basically just think of Facebook. And they are trying to construct a world in which all of the internet lives within the walled garden of Facebook. And that is what I think ultimately is what's so dangerous for these publishers, because they are aligning themselves with a business that has very different commercial interests and commercial values than these publishers do.
And remember, Gabe, I mean, it was just a few years ago that people were saying, well, Facebook's doing okay, but they haven't figured out mobile. They haven't been able to monetize mobile. And now, look, they've basically caused a revolution here.
Yes, and that is, you know, one of the other big lessons from this partnership that we're learning is that basically Facebook has cracked the code of mobile. They've created an advertising platform that works on mobile, and now publishers are having to flock there in hopes of capturing those eyeballs and the revenue that Facebook is able to generate.
Is it possible that this is a good thing for everyone in the sense that nothing gets cannibalized here? There's just a rising tide of more boats, and that Facebook becomes the sort of free introduction to the New York Times. And if you want to buy their content, you go to their site.
Well, you've articulated, I think, the rosy view that New York Times executives hope is the case, is that this is going to broaden the audience of New York Times readers, expose more people, especially younger people, to the New York Times, and they will convert them to paying subscribers. I think that is an optimistic view, but it's too early to tell. But yes, that is the hope here.
Gabriel Sherman, National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine. Thanks so much, Gabe.
Thanks for having me.
Hey there. Doing anything tonight?
This is Alina Gabash from Seattle, Washington. And my idea of a perfect evening is dinner at my favorite restaurant and a good book.
Okay, so a lovely young person all by themselves in a restaurant. They probably need some company, right?
Hi. Did anyone ever tell you that you have the face of a Botticelli and the body of a Degas?
I'm a 10th grade art teacher.
Whoa, all by yourself? That's a sad little party.
Hi, this is Roxanne from Atlanta. My perfect evening alone would be dinner by the beach without the kids.
A perfect evening alone? You can't be serious.
Hi, this is Charlotte. I'm calling from Tennessee. My idea of a perfect evening alone would consist of a candlelit bubble bath, relaxing mood music, delicious red wine, medicinal herbs, and decadent dinner and dessert.
Can I ask you a very personal question? Did anyone ever tell you
that I have the face of a Botticelli? Think of something original. Some guy used that on me this morning.
Well, new research suggests that people you might see dining or watching a movie or catching a show alone are actually having a lot more fun than you might think. And maybe you shouldn't interrupt their bliss. Joining me now is Rebecca Ratner, professor of marketing at the Robert H. Smith School of Business. I guess it's a good gig being out on your own, eh, Rebecca?
Yeah. You know, it's really hard for people sometimes to do things alone. But what we find is that when they do it, they actually can enjoy it quite a lot.
So there's a threshold you have to get over, and that consists of some of the stigmas that we referred to maybe in the introduction.
Yes. What we find is that people are afraid that if they go do something for fun, alone in public, that other people are going to think they don't have friends.
And, you know, in this era now, people are doing a lot more alone because, you know, you see people in Starbucks with their laptops all by themselves. This is now extending itself into the evening nightlife.
Well, you know, a lot more people are either single now than they used to be, or, you know, with the dual career couples juggling families, it's hard to have an activity partner to just get out for the night and do something. And so you've got a lot of people who are confronted with something that they want to do. Maybe it's in the evening, maybe it's just an afternoon activity, going to an art exhibit, going to see a parade that's coming through town, and they just don't have anyone who's available or interested in that particular activity. It's not that these are people necessarily who don't have a lot of friends. They may. It's just, you know, it's probably happened to all of us. It's definitely happened to me that I've had things I wanted to do, but I just don't happen to have someone available to see it with me. And then the question is, do I go or do I just stay home?
Or do you miss it? And there's no reason to miss it, is what you're saying. What kinds of stories were you hearing in your research that surprised you about people kind of getting over the hump here?
Well, yeah, I mean, what really surprised me is how universal this is, that people say, I'm afraid to do stuff alone because I think that other people will think I'm a loser. And I've presented this work in Turkey, in Singapore, in China, and all over, people are telling me the same story. They're afraid of what strangers will think of them if they go out into these public spaces and they do fun activities alone.
So there is an entire solo nightlife that remains to be unleashed somehow if restaurants and hotels and marketers can figure out how to get at this untapped anxiety.
Exactly. And I think it's going to take some, you know, some clever moves on their part. But as one example, restaurants, you know, very often have tables set for two, or, you know, tables set for four for a bigger table. But what if they had some tables set for one? Or what if they had some kind of a special for people who arrive alone, or some kind of an activity that people who are alone can do? Even if the activity, maybe it's something in the interest of the restaurant, maybe they could have those solo consumers rate the items.
What's your favorite recommendation for going out alone? And how difficult was it for you to experiment with getting over the threshold on your own?
Oh, gosh, such a good question. So the reason we started this project is on a Sunday afternoon. It was very important that it was a Sunday because that's a less sort of social time of the week. I worked up the courage to go see a play alone, so live theater. And right after seeing the play, I went and I met my colleague who became my co-author on this paper, Rebecca Hamilton, met her for dinner, and I was telling her how much I had enjoyed this play. And I think it was important to me to work up the courage to go, that, as I said, that it be an off-peak time. And what we found in our research is that when consumers are considering going out solo, they rather go at a time that's off peak. So, for example, people in our studies prefer to go to see a movie on a Saturday night than on a Sunday night. Not surprising. In general, they prefer Saturday night movies. But if they're going to be alone, they prefer to go on a Sunday because they think the theater will be more empty and there'll be fewer people to see them. One other thing that we find is that people are more comfortable doing activities alone that are functional, or maybe serve some kind of learning purpose or accomplish something. For example, you know, going to the grocery store, that's a utilitarian, that's a useful activity. No one would feel really uncomfortable going to the grocery store, the cleaners alone. You wouldn't expect someone to have a companion necessarily. So that play that I told you about, that play was actually a story about a female scientist, and it was a true story. It was nonfiction, and she had helped to discover the structure of DNA that then Watson and Crick got more of the credit for. But that was a great topic for me to see alone. That would have been really hard for me to go see something like, you know, Romeo and Juliet by myself.
When you do challenging theater, sometimes it's actually tough with a date, particularly a new date, someone you don't know very well, because afterwards you don't necessarily know what to say. Maybe they didn't like it. If you really liked it, you're kind of worried a little bit. You know, there's concern, and sometimes maybe you're thinking, oh, is he bored or is she bored? You know, it's a lot less fuss if you're by yourself.
Right. I mean, isn't that so freeing? I mean, that's what we're really hoping, is that people can start to redefine a little bit what it means to be a solo consumer, and realize that all of us have times where it's probably a healthy thing for us to get out sometimes and do things by ourselves.
Get out on your own. You secretly want to. You know you do. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Ratner is professor of marketing at the Robert H. Smith School of Business. And here's something to take with you today. One of you out there was really mesmerized by this being alone conversation. It sounded like a dream with limitless options to one of you from Grand Prairie, Texas, who wrote, "A perfect evening alone is actually just getting to be alone. It never happens," you write. Here's a list of what Grand Prairie would do with even 100 seconds of solitude. 1, catch up on a show. 2, start a book that they would never finish. 3, work on my kids' memory books. 4, rearrange furniture. 5, be at home. 6, go to bed early. The last two are my only givens for a perfect night alone, if only, you write. Need to get out more, Grand Prairie, but I hear you. That's all for today, but I want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations in addition to getting plenty of sleep. Be a part of our listener response network by signing up for our texts. 1 text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program. It's not a hard question. Your voice will become part of the on-air conversation, though. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply, and you can reply STOP to opt out. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Moo, working to help businesses stand out with a range of business cards and printed products for telling a company's unique story. Also offering Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. Learn more at moo.com.